Phil, some of you might not know, has recently retired, and he's having a lot of difficulty giving up the Paul Constant pseudonym. But he tells me that you don't have to call him Paul, but he's going to continue using Paul Constant on the internet. And by the way, he has a spectacular internet site, if any of you don't know, new people particularly, called searchwithin.org. Phil has been a wonderful friend to me, and he's he was actually with Richard Rose from 1985 to 1995. I feel a little weird introducing people like you and Bob, who everybody knows already. But in recent years, Phil has, folks, I'm having trouble giving it up too. Phil has directed most of his efforts towards integrating body, mind, and essence through what he calls rapport. And he's also continued to facilitate retreats. And he asked me to, one of the things I was supposed to include, that he's a TAT Foundation member, but he's a lot more than that. And as someone mentioned last night, there was a period of a number of years where Phil almost single-handedly kept TAT functioning. He has a wonderful wife named Cindy, and the two of them were adopted by two kittens in 2013. We're really lucky to have him is our first speaker this morning. Phil?
Good morning, everybody. I'm gonna try using this, see if this will work. We have some, as we age and tap, a couple people are having trouble hearing, so. You can get this to work. How does that sound? Any better?
Yeah.
Good?
Louder than natural sounding.
All right. So I'm going to do a couple of exercises. I feel like these direct pointing exercises are helpful to get to something that I see more and more in my life. And these are from Locke Kelly. And Locke Kelly has put out a book, Shift into Freedom. So what I'm going to do is just take you through these at about 5 minutes each. And it'll become a little more apparent as we go through. So there's three different exercises here. And the goal here really is to demonstrate the limitations of awareness and the possibilities of awareness. So what I'd like you to do is, somewhere behind my left shoulder here, look at the corner near the ceiling and just get a basic impression of it. So pick something out. Okay, and close your eyes. Now bring your attention to the space behind your eyes and allow it to rest there. Don't analyze or judge anything. Just rest in that space. And through your closed eyes, allow your attention to slowly drift outward to the corner of the room that I pointed out. Just allow your attention to rest there as if it's a spotlight shining on an object. Now slowly retroverse your attention from the corner of the room and bring your attention to your left ear and hear my voice and other sounds there. And you can actually feel your attention there in and around your ear. Now move your attention to the space behind your eyes and just simply rest in that space. Okay. Okay, now go ahead and open your eyes. And that's what I call an outward bound exercise. So the point of that is just to show that your awareness at its most basic level can be directed outward. So this next one will be an inward bound exercise. So go ahead and close your eyes. And bring your attention from your head and slowly sink down into your heart. So down through your neck, into your shoulders, into your heart. And just feel the area in your chest and around your heart. And allow your attention to drop down to the rise and fall of your belly as you breathe in and out. You may find yourself wanting to analyze what's happening, but just keep your attention below your neck without actually looking down from your head. Now really just sink into your body and just feel what's going on in there. You might feel your bum sitting on the chair, the temperature on your skin, the joints in certain areas in your body, your heart beating, your belly rising and falling. Okay, so go ahead and open your eyes. And basically what I'm showing there is you can direct your attention inward. So this is just a basic, there's nothing mysterious about this. I'm not trying to point to anything that isn't really evident. It's just a basic pointing inward into your body, into yourself. And then this last exercise is the third exercise. Before I actually go into it, I want to mention that there's a certain benefit to this, what I call a dichotomy. It's kind of a split between what is watching, something that seems more real, versus what is in the view itself, what you're actually watching. So in that case, like the corner in the room, your thoughts, your feelings and sensations in your body. So there's a separateness that something is watching. The viewer, the witness, the observer, it's all referred to different things. Now the one fundamental flaw in that line of thinking is we feel that we're in control of that attention. So I just walked you through some exercises and you directed your attention outward, you directed it inward. So we really feel like we're in control of that attention. And that is where we feel that's very personal. We feel that's us. And that's kind of where the error in the observation is. So this next exercise, I'll take you a little bit further and I call this nowhere bound. And don't like beat yourself up. Don't try to analyze as we go through this. There's no right or wrong. I'm just trying to put you at ease with the process itself. So let's go ahead and close your eyes. And bring your attention from your head and slowly sink into your heart. Feel the area in your chest and around your heart. And allow your attention to move out to the space around you, 360 degrees around and even above and below you. Just allow your attention very easily to expand outward to the walls of the room. And try to keep your attention from going back into your head and giving too much attention to thoughts or judgments or any analysis. So even though this attention feels outside of you and you can allow it to rest there, you can also feel your entire body at the same time. So allow your awareness to relax and become interested in objectless space. Just notice the subtle shift from awareness of space to just simply noticing that space is aware. And allow awareness to be aware of itself as contentless and formless field of awareness. And just feel this field both outside and inside your body. And the key here is to just relax and stop trying. Just allow your outside world and your inside world to reach equilibrium. Just awareness being aware. Go ahead and open your eyes. So this is what I call, and this was the point of Locke's book, Shifting to Freedom, this very simple allowing yourself to rest in awareness. It does involve a bit of attention, and it involves a bit of effort, but I feel like a lot of people do when they meditate or when they're trying too hard, they're missing the point of just this subtle shift from what I was trying to point to is this awareness, which is always present. You can't miss it. You can't not be aware. Just shifting from the noise of your mind, the thoughts and stuff that come up in you, feelings, just that very subtle shift into what the substance of what those things are arising in. So that's kind of what I'm talking about with a direct pointing technique. And this is the fundamental thing we're all looking for as seekers, but it's so obvious we're missing it. So we're very captivated by the mind's noise, but missing the substance in which all that noise arises into. So it's a very subtle shift, again, from what appears to be right here, the inner dialogue and whatnot, the feelings into just what that is rising in. So I'll try to go into that a little bit more with some real life experiences for me. So before coming here this weekend, I humorously thought of why the name Paul Constant came up, and I have no idea where that, I think it was actually Art Tickner that gave that to me someday, years and years ago. And I was a little bit worried about, more than a little bit, about putting my name on the website. And
wise man.
Yeah, I'm still feel more resolute that was a good choice. Just want to do that for the website. It doesn't matter in person, the pseudonym. But the constants in my life for the past 30 years in seeking, in starting in my late teens. So I'm going to go through a little bit of my own story here, and then later on I'll talk about some tips and things, some lessons learned over the years of after 30 years of staring at my mind. But one of the constants was friendship on the spiritual path. And as Larry said, Richard Rose's quote was, "There is no religion greater than human friendship." And I really feel strongly about that. I really feel that the friendship itself, in many ways, is better than even having a teacher. They both have their roles. There's an African proverb that I like. If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And so, I give a lot of weight to working together, which I find very unique in TAT, that people, it's mostly a peer-to-peer working, even the teachers. What I find interesting, you can go into this hall and we're having lunch, you can't tell who's teaching or who's a student. So it's a very equalized approach. And this friendship to me is very key. The second thing is, for those that know me, is honesty, and by that I mean self-honesty. I feel like that's a very vital part of this whole spiritual path. Just admitting to, in a way, all the flaws and whatnot. And just being honest with yourself as you see aspects of yourself, as you get more and more clear with yourself as you go down this road. So as I wrote, as Larry said, I have a website, searchwithin.org, and I had a realization in 2007. It was in a community building on the farm. I'll go into that in a little bit. But right after that, I wrote about the doubts that arose as a result of that experience. So it was within a few days I wrote this summary because it was all fresh in my mind, and I posted it out there. And a lot of you, I've been down the road seeking together side by side with these doubts, and I just feel like that I've just been wide open with my experience as over the years since 2007. And the third thing I would say is love of truth and devotion. And I just, for me, I just love the mystery of reality. I love the mystery of the search. And if there's anything I can do today, it's to fuel that love in you, because it's, in many ways, it's a painful seeking. Can be morose. It doesn't need to be morose, but we all make it this very painful process. But there's this other side that should be joyful. It should be a wonderful unfolding experience. And for me, it's been that way. So just, I know there's a couple of people here, six, I guess, who haven't met me. And for those of you who heard the story, I'll apologize, which you're not supposed to do. But so I had an awakening. I met Richard Rose in 1985. I'd been seeking a couple years before I met him. I've been reading some books. And we had moved from the Tat farmhouse in 2001, I think it was. So let me go back a bit. So I was with Richard Rose for 10 years. And as many of you know, he had Alzheimer's in 1995 and departed Tat. And those were some difficult years for Tat after the main teacher, who was a very strong personality, departed the scene. So we fumbled along for a while. And in fact, I think there were some meetings where there were a half dozen of us sitting in a Tat meeting wondering what we're going to do. So we decided to finish the community building on the hill, which Richard Rose started in the early 70s. And it sputtered along, some parts of it got built, and then it just laid, you know, without any activity for years. But in 2001, we said, okay, this is it, we're going to do it. And I think there were maybe 25 of us that day. We got up before dark, got everybody together, and we put the shell on the piece of the community building that did not have a kitchen and a bathroom. So we essentially made it functional. We worked all the way through to the end of the day. And then over the years, many people had just devoted so much time into making that building a meeting space. And so that's where I went into an isolation on a weekend, and I was 43 years old, and essentially had everything stripped away in an experience of just sitting in that building. One weekend I went into isolation, and I was just trying to clean up, sat down, decided I was going to meditate. And so after 22 years of seeking, I reached the ground of my being. Everything was stripped away, and all that was left was nothingness. The thing with this was, after 22 years of beating down the gate with a battering ram, once I saw what I was stunned by the simplicity of what had been in front of me the whole time. And because of that, it sort of tripped me up. I figured nothing could be the simple that I had been searching for the whole time for 22 years. And therefore, because of the simplicity that was staring back at me, I could not accept that that was the absolute. And so it led to grave doubts. And that, there again, that's why I wrote about the doubts that occurred. Now, this this awakening, there's so many different kinds of people that have different experiences, manifest in many different ways just because we're all wired differently. So you hear experiences of nothingness, emptiness, stillness, love, perfection, infinite vastness. There's many, many descriptions of this strong taste. And there's also probably depths. You know, some people have a little taste. Stuff has been removed. Some people, I feel like Richard Rose, where everything was just stripped away. And I'll talk a little bit about what can unfold as a result of that experience. So not everything happens at once. Unfortunately, you know, that's what we're all looking for. We're going to find this answer. It's going to solve everything for life. That's it. And I can go on with my life. Generally, that does not happen. It takes time to unfold. So that realization answered the one question, which is a biggie. What happens when I die? And that to me was a clear answer that nothing dies. So it removed the fear of death. That was a big outcome of the realization. But it left this, those of you that were around me in years, the niggling thing was, what is meant by everythingness? What are people talking about? I had an experience of nothingness, but, you know, everythingness, WTF, what are they talking about? I couldn't get the sense of what that meant. And so there I went, you know, down a path again in this long agonizing search for something else. So in 2012, so this is about 5 years after my realization, one of the things that that I've always loved in TAT, going back to Richard Rose, was sitting in rapport. So rapport means in harmony with others. It means in harmony with, essentially, but it can mean in this endeavor, in harmony with others. And ultimately you find that you get in harmony with capital S self, which is your true nature. And so this has always been a captivating thing for me. And there was a teacher who came to Raleigh in 2012. I'm not going to mention names because I don't want people to go chasing teachers. I have another teacher I'll talk about too. I'll be glad to say something about it in a personal conversation when we're not recording. But I went to see this teacher because I had heard she's sitting in silence. And to me, you know, that's what we did with Richard Rose. We sat in silence as a group, kind of like what we did here this morning. And we'll do that again this evening. We'll have a silent rapport sitting. And so that captivated me. And when I went, the funny thing is, I went there, it was a 7-day retreat, and I went for 2 days. And I was so enamored with the teacher and what was going on. I called work, called my wife, that I'm staying another day. And then the next day, I called work, called home, so I'm staying another day. So I was just so enthralled to have this sitting, this setting with people sitting together in silence. And eventually, I fell into this very deep love with the teacher. It was classic bhakti, a bhakti love, a bhakti approach. And so those that knew me back then, I was like way up here. I was like, what are they talking about feeling? What are feelings? So I had none of that. And this teacher just opened up my heart. It really just took me by storm, totally by surprise. And in a way, that's kind of some lessons learned, I think, with teachers. They're always a two-edged sword. And I literally threw myself at the foot of the teacher. And there's some cutting edges to the swords in doing stuff like that. And not that there's anything egregious. Nothing happened with the teacher. There's no physical interaction. And it was just, again, as I said, a classic bhakti love. The other thing that happened with this is I used to meditate. Richard Rose talked about a walking meditation. That was always my meditation. So I would go out and direct my attention inward, watch my mind. But through this teacher, I learned to sit. And I learned to sit with myself in silence for a long period of time. And, you know, there's a lot to that. People have been doing this for centuries, sitting, first of all, in groups, you know, there's in religion, and then outside of that to kind of get your own independence, sitting by yourself. So as I mentioned, this teacher opened my heart. Richard Rose, in a way, following his teaching, blew open my head. So in a way, as painful as this extra seeking was, it was amazing that I could have a realization from this mental side, and then have this very deep love and a deep love for reality on the heart side. Now, I mentioned the double-edged sword, so there was all these benefits that I just mentioned. The drawback was, even with this deep realization, there was this series of strong mental constructs about what enlightenment is. And this is the seeker's failure. We're always building constructs about what enlightenment is. And I love the term. Lisa's friend Chuck, who was here last year, he refers to it as the grand mal event. We're all waiting for enlightenment to be the grand mal event. And in a way, you know, I had my story, and it makes a great story, and it is just a story, but I wrote about what happened to me in a community building, and that's what it was. It was a great story, and it sounded like a grand mal event. But we're always then waiting for the next big event that's going to change us, as I say, pop us into a bubble and protect us from life, and we'll be in this constant state of bliss. So I just want to mention that even with a deep realization, there's still these strong tendencies for the mind to generate constructs. And I was chasing phantoms, again, in a different way, projecting things on a teacher and what enlightenment should be. So in March of this year, and I haven't told too many people this, I attended a retreat, and you can pretty much guess. There were 300 people there. And this decision was kind of, it was on a whim, and I didn't really know why I was going, but I knew there was some reason to go. For one thing, there's a scholarship program with this retreat, so they will waive either the tuition or the lodging or both. And they just give you a one-page application. They ask you how much you make. They ask you to give you a summary of, like a one-paragraph summary of your seeking. So literally on the, taking a page out of Richard Rose's book on betweenness, I wrote up this application, folded it up, threw it in the mail, and totally forgot about it. You know, every now and then a thought would bubble up about that retreat. So that was last September, and then about a month later, I got a notice that I was accepted. So it was like, here you go, you know, on a silver platter. Here's an opportunity to go to a retreat and save some money, and they are expensive. So I couldn't refuse what was put in front of me as a nice gift. And this teacher, the cool thing, which really surprised me, I'd been listening to audio recordings, and the cool thing was the way he told stories and the humor was very reminiscent of Richard Rose. It was like he would just get 300 people laughing in a way that just put me at ease. But it was very nostalgic in a way just to hear the teacher tell stories and keep people laughing. But what I found, I think just listening to the audio recordings going into the retreat, I just had a respect for what he was saying. So I did, it was a bit different than the second teacher. It wasn't like he was, you know, on a pedestal. He was very ordinary, just a guy you'd run into in a supermarket and be able to talk to. That's what I felt around him. But I had the respect that through the week, when he systematically took every one of my constructs that I had been deeply believing in, and just in a classic reverse vector, you know, approach of Richard Rose, just tore one thing down after another. So the constructs that I that had been in me, just to give you some examples, this should be an elimination of ego. How many of us believe that, that this spiritual path is a systematic destruction of ego? Well, this teacher talks about a healthy ego. And you can have a mature, healthy ego as a spiritual seeker and just going, life will generally do that to you as you mature. So there was just still some idea that, you know, enlightenment was destruction of ego or destruction of self. Attachment, that was another good one. You know, this was an elimination, enlightenment is an elimination of all attachments, where what I felt his storytelling did was say there is an attachment that are attachments that are healthy. There's attachments to your loved ones, your parents, your kids, your spouse. And so those were some examples. I can't think of the others. But what it ended up doing by the end of the week, in combination of sitting in silence with 300 people, and you talk about rapport, you know, so I was in heaven. 300 people, you could hear a pin drop. But at the end of the week, I realized that this last piece of scaffolding that was propping small s self up was self-doubt. And so I knew it was there. I knew I had written about it, but it becomes kind of like in the background. And by self-doubt, I mean the fact that the realization in 2007 that I had sort of set aside was now just revealed to be, that's authentic, that's it. And so with that happening, and I don't want to make, again, I don't want to give an impression of a grand mal event, just it was very subtle. Things, what I would call equalized. And so there's this depth of nothingness, but then, we were talking about this at breakfast, there's this other side of all of our flaws and our smallest self. And that's what I'm talking about, an equalization between capital S self, small s self. And I'll have some examples here in a bit. So I also realized that how deep this conditioning is. I had no idea how deep, deep, deep things have been embedded. And all of us have those. We tend to blame ourselves for them, but that's just life. You know, life is conditioning us. That we have experiences and memories and whatnot. And there's nothing wrong with that. So it's kind of like a... what I would say, a lover might be able to say it later. So there's another aspect of this is there's a freedom from self, small s self, and then freedom to allow small s self to be there. That's kind of an example of equilibrium. That's kind of an example of balance. So we all have this impression, we hear about the self being eliminated, but there's an acceptance of all the flaws. And a really good example would be fear. You know, I really dislike sitting up here with 30 sets of eyes on me. But there's an acceptance, with the binoculars. So there's an acceptance of that fear. That's just, I'm just not an extrovert, I'm more of an introverted personality. So having everybody's eyes, you know, seeing through me is something that I've learned to accept better. And in a way, I could trip you up to hear things about people eliminating all fears. And maybe that's the case. I don't know. Or they've had just so much fear that when you know, 90 pounds of fear is removed and you still have 10 pounds of it, it feels like a huge burden's been lifted. So there's a peaceful coexistence between what I am and what I am not. And there's like a what I would call a dynamic equilibrium. So we're looking for some constant. We're looking for balance. That's what a seeker is generally looking for, some unchanging experience in life that protects us from life. But that's not, unfortunately, that's not the way the game plays out. And where I was saying before, where I pushed, was the battering ram hitting the gate when all I needed to do was turn around and see that the garden had been there the whole time. These days, I'm much, much more prone to say, you know, just relax into this. This is why I was going through some of those exercises, just trying to point to what's here instead of scurrying around, spinning in circles, which, you know, worked wonders for me at a time. That was a big part of Richard Rose's teachings, to be very determined. But this is, I feel like more of a relaxing into it can be a bit of a quicker path. But who knows? You know, we all need to go through our thing. I mentioned fears, and I'm the first fear to me under Richard Rose, which his teachings showed, was the removal of the fear of death. The second teacher was the removal of the fear of love, because as I said, I didn't know what feelings were. It was all up here. And so I didn't, unbeknownst to myself, there was a fear of love. And, there was a time I wouldn't even have said, I love you. But that is just a dissipated fear. You know, it's just part of this opening. And the last is the fear of life. You know, we're all afraid of life. And those are three fundamental reductions in fear, I guess you could put it that way. Stripping away a fear. So you might see, after going through that, why I have titled this Shifting Our Attention from the Unreal to the Real and Everything in Between. And so as you go along the path, you might feel this opening in yourself, this more opening to more and more, and I'll give you some examples here. So silence, you hear a lot of people experience their depth as silence, but silence opens to sound. There's an equilibrium there. Stillness opens to movement. Consciousness opens to all objects in consciousness. Awareness, and I'm talking about everyday awareness, not something with fairy dust on it. You know, we have this idea when you hear teachers talk about awareness that it's something special. The everyday garden variety awareness that's inherent in all of us, it opens to all forms, all experiences, all thoughts, all feelings. When were you ever not aware? And doesn't your awareness accept everything unconditionally? It can't know otherwise. It can't do otherwise. And I'm not talking about the mind accepting anything. So we open to the unknown. And I'm reminded of Richard Rose's quote, "What do you know for sure?" And we open to our deeply human flaws. There's just, we were talking about that at breakfast. Somebody called it the stink, you know. This part of us that we don't want to open to. And that's the openness. That's the flower opening in this process as you go down the path. And we open to even more discoveries. So we're always tinkering with our experience in futile attempts to manipulate our lives instead of simply allowing reality to discover itself, to have a direct perception without the mind's filters, just to be here with what is. And this applies whether you're meditating or going through your life. And for whatever reason, seeking somehow needs to exhaust itself. You know, I feel like, as I was preparing for this, I felt like the image comes to mind of those cartoon characters where the road roller runs over them, and then they pick them up and they're like this flat piece of pancake, you know, like pancake. That's what I feel like. It's like it's like I've been wrung out. It's the seeking has been wrung out, just flattened. And we can reach a firmer seeing of our true nature in everything. And again, this is why I say it answered my question about everythingness. I won't go into Jacob's Ladder because I know some people glaze over and they hear me talk about it. But, you know, if you go back to Jacob's Ladder, to me, there's more. It's like a revealing puzzle. It just keeps revealing more and more as I think about it. But there's a balance within the triangles. You know, it talks about the, somebody help me out. What was Benoit's principle? Conciliatory principle. Yeah, so each triangle has a balance from a superior perspective. And again, I won't go into it, but there's also the Jacob's Ladder consists of the body, the mind, and essence. And there's a balance within those three areas. So our minds are great at hashing things out, but we can go way too far into the self-inquiry intellectual path. Our love is great at feeling our way, but we can get way too far into the lovey-dovey, you know, feeling side of this. And our body is super intelligent. We are like this bundle of very sensitive nerves, very complex. It's an amazing organism if you really think about it. And we are a super sensitive instrument. But you can get too wrapped up into Kundalini, the body energy, and you can literally get drunk on Shakti. I've had that happen. And I've been flattened on my face through Shakti, sitting in a rapport sitting. So these are very real things. These aren't imagination. These are very real paths that people gravitate to. But I'm saying there's a balance here between the body, the mind, and essence, and accepting that. And another way to maybe look at this is synergy. There's a synergism. For instance, maybe as babies, you know, we are pure awareness. We might even have, there's a bit of a personality there, but there's really no sense of self. And then as we age, we develop this sense of self, this sense of separateness with an ego, however you want to define the word ego. And then, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but then there's a synergy between that pure awareness and this sense of self. And that's what I mean about the balance. And so our lives can be like this dynamic equilibrium. But often we're not seeing it. So as you go down this path, you can tune into, it's almost like a muscle. You know, another way of looking at this could be like a sculptor or an artist, whatever you get good at. This can apply to this way of watching your mind, where that becomes a more developed and honed skill. When you think about it less, you're less captivated by the noise of the mind, the thoughts and the feelings. And you're just tuning into what's here, that awareness that I was talking about, and it becomes very natural. It becomes much, much more natural. When you hear teachers talk about abiding or stability in that, that's what I mean by you can develop this sense of presence. And that's what the exercise was, particularly the third exercise that I did. So there's a bunch of paradigms in the teachings. And another thing, when you get down this path, you start to see the validity of the separate sides of the spectrums. And for instance, the path of resistance, that was my path under Richard Rose. I resisted thought. You know, I was celibate, so I resisted nature's urges. I could probably list a whole series of things. But then there's this other equally valid path of acceptance. So there's this, you've heard, not this, neti neti, versus this too. My will, control, effort, versus thy will, trust, surrender, or let it be. Movement versus stillness. Thought versus no thought. Form versus emptiness. What you are, what you aren't. Finite, infinite. Everythingness, nothingness. And your mind will absolutely does its thing beautifully. It will try to latch on to either side of those opposites that I just mentioned, which is fine. That's what the mind does. But there is something in between all of that. It includes both of those, both opposites. Okay, so that's enough pontificating. I will go on to what I consider tips. So I have, I think, 7 or 8 of these. These are, I thought about this, might be a strong statement, but if you ever want to learn how to run a business, you could find out how the other businesses failed. So these are, in a way, I spun these from my own failures into something that I feel like you could use yourself. I don't think I had trouble with the first one. I mentioned remember your love of truth. And amazingly enough, you've all experienced this. When you walk away from here, it's very easy to forget. We just, life is very captivating. So our minds are very captivating. And it's easy to forget our love of truth. And along with this, I don't really think I need to say much more about it, but there's some things I feel that are helpful. I mentioned the deep self-honesty with yourself, really just seeing things about yourself that are totally uncomfortable, but yet allowing them to be there. And they'll just take on less life. And sometimes it takes a long time, depending on the strength of the thing that's got a hold of you. But deep self-honesty can allow that to pass through you a bit quicker. Gratitude is a big one. It takes it off of yourself, and you're saying something beyond me, a person, life, whatever you're expressing your gratitude to. Is a way of just sort of letting go of control and saying that something else is in play here. Selflessness, openness, compassion, these to me all express it well. The second one, watch yourself in the present moment. So you can watch thoughts and feelings arise in you without engaging or tinkering. That, to me, is the key. It wasn't too long ago where the thoughts were driving me crazy. It was like the narrative, the dialogue that was going on was somehow not spiritual. That was kind of one of the constructs I had. And there's something about spiritual circles. We all think, oh my God, thoughts are not spiritual. Thoughts have a very real place in life. If you have to think for your job, you have to figure out how to solve problems, how to do your taxes, whatever. You need to think. But you can watch those. In this process, you can watch those and recognize how captivating they are. And by this I mean like self-referential thoughts, beliefs, emotions, this inner dialogue, the blah, blah, blah that carries on in our heads. And I I used the word without engaging or tinkering, but notice that I didn't say escape from or push away. Because that's where, when I said they were driving me crazy, I was trying to push them away. And they were just equal and opposite for us, saying, uh-uh, you know, this is not, you're not going to stuff me into a box and put duct tape, tie my hands. And because as soon as you try to do that, it's going to be a pissed and come back with a vengeance. So just another side story. And I think that's actually what some people do when they're trying to meditate. They're trying to stuff everything into a box and escape from it, which isn't the most productive way to go. So rather than trying to stop thoughts and feelings, you can simply watch passively, which immediately reduces the momentum of thought. And I'm not saying, you know, sit on the couch, watch the tube, and just kind of like, you know, have a beer, and that's not what I mean by passive. But it's quite different than resisting or trying to disassociate yourself from your thinking. So the takes, again, as I said, there's a little shift, there's a bit of an effort to shifting away from that noise, that mental noise, and more into what's happening now. And there will be a byproduct, which the thoughts will tend to calm down. Are you going to give me a 5 minute?
11 minutes.
Okay, great.
We're going to leave some time for questions. Or not.
But this does involve perseverance, and I just want to think that's a key ingredient in this process. Discover friendship and rapport. And friendship to me is a consciousness seeking cohesiveness, one. It's trying to be one. It's the opposite of entropy. And allow yourself to open up through rapport with others and with yourself. You know, be kind to yourself. How many of us have said, I can't do this, I'm too weak? You can come up with a whole litany of reasons, and flaws in yourself. Trust in it. And here, this is more of an aligning with reality, allowing life to unfold. Perhaps letting go of control a little bit at a time if you can't do it. Most of us can't let go of that sense of control. And you can notice the serendipity in your life. I've noticed this. It's like that scholarship application. That's just one example. So many things that have happened that have laid the course out of it. Just get out of the way and let things present themselves. Get three more. And what's getting your attention? Because back to the immediacy of your experience right now. What is getting your attention? You know, nothing magical or complex about this. Very simple. What is captivating your attention? Is it your thoughts? Or is it what is the substance in which thoughts and feelings arise in? What is now present and intimate? You could actually feel outward. That could be a sense, a different way of feeling this. The path, as I mentioned, involves unraveling and relinquishing these deep-seated beliefs, and you get that by watching yourself. What's your life trajectory? That's the next one. This is like your intention. You're here. You're at a TAP meeting. You're expressing your attention with action, physically. You know, your volition. Rose called it the reverse vector. You know, your momentum away from untruth. It's a larger picture of your life, your life's direction. And the last thing there, and I didn't put these in any kind of order, but actually this one I feel is pretty important. Find time to be with yourself. And you can use silence. I find silence to be very powerful, sitting by myself. But use whatever's best for you. Meditation is a good tool in this regard, because it basically is exposing yourself to what is. It can be very confrontational. You know, you're just you and your thoughts and feelings. There's nothing else going on. There's no distractions. And you're tenaciously watching what arises and it will eventually exhaust all possibilities. And deep meditation can actually bring you to this place of what I would call moving balance between motion and stillness. So attention then remains fixed on now. Thoughts come, they go. Thoughts are the same as the birds, the sounds. You can consider it the same. One's cognitive, one is a sensation, but I'm just saying let those come and go. But see the substance. What makes you tick? You can really find that out when you're meditating. I think the body has a role here. It is a great anchor. And the neuroscience is showing us what is happening in the brain when you're shifting your attention into now. And it's just the neurons that are creating the thoughts aren't getting the energy, and they're just sort of reverting back to their natural state. So there's a really, really good science going on in the last 10 years. We've had Gary Weber here who's talked about that. And I just want to mention, you know, you can do meditation walking, you can do it sitting, but I feel like this much more relaxed approach and allowing things to arise and fall away is much more conducive. So that's all I had. We can do questions if we have time.
We do. Would you entertain questions?
Yeah, sure.
I'm the only one.
Bob?
This is more of a comment, but the same retreat we were at, you know, he likes to say quite often, in the end, everything comes back to be reclaimed. Mm. You were kind of talking about accepting those parts of yourself that got split off, kind of. And so it's a big emphasis for him to bring it all back, or Jung's saying the gold's in the shadow.
What I find unique about him is this. He really addresses people that have had awakenings. He's really moved more and more into that. And that was very nourishing to me in a way, just to, as I said, it still was what I would call a reverse vector, cutting backing. He wasn't saying this is truth. He's cutting things down that are propping up false. And so that's where his strength is in people that have had strong taste or awakenings.
Please. I wanted to know what it was you wanted to say that you couldn't get out.
As I was preparing, it reminded me of a lover who I merged with in the community building, but abandoned. And that lover was with me the whole time. And so I came back home. And of course, you know, that lover's with you all too. You can't miss it. You're just pushing it away. Thank you all.